cities. Some years they venture even farther south. In fact, it's this itinerant life that earned them the name Bohemian, although the name seems equally well-suited to their unconventional and exquisite appearance. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Cloud computing, artificial intelligence, and new manufacturing plants are creating a fast-growing demand for electricity.
So we have an imperative in this country right now to grow the electric grid to support a number of key industries.
Brian Janis co-founded Cloverleaf Infrastructure, which works with companies and utilities to tackle the challenge. He says it starts with optimizing the energy resources we already have. For example, utilities can adopt software systems that monitor the grid and route power in real time to transmission lines that are not at capacity. It's like rerouting car traffic to avoid bottlenecks. And with more battery storage, energy generated at low demand times can be stored and used when needed. But even with these improvements, energy generation will need to increase. Janis says that in the short term, to ramp up supply quickly, utilities will likely turn to fossil fuels. So to limit the climate impact of increased energy demand in the long term, it's important to plan ahead and invest in clean energy.
It's about how do you build that runway and that path towards ultimately using this increase in demand to actually move us forward in terms of decarbonization rather than backward.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Today, from the Wings Archive.
How many times do we separate from each other because we don't want to do the work?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Bell Hooks died on December 15, 2021, at her home in Berea, Kentucky, at age 69. Many obituaries list her credentials, her influence, and her 30 or so books. People are posting favorite Bell Hooks quotes all over social media. Hooks is also justly famous for her blunt, clear, and loving lectures.
How many times do we separate from each other because we don't want to do the work of confronting, because confronting may be bringing pain? How many times do white women and women of color say to me, well, you know, I just dropped out of this because I couldn't deal with those white women anymore. And yet, we will hang into relationships working with them. I said, how many of us have an intimate relationship where we never get angry, where we never have impulses of rage? What we believe is that even in the midst of those impulses of anger or rage, it is our greater good, our collective feeling of care that will guide us. Why don't we feel the same thing in our movements? Why don't you feel the same thing at those meetings when you are locking heads with women of color and men of color over issues of difference? Around racism, around classism. Why don't bourgeois black women who are confronting working class women who say, you don't understand our issues, feel that same willingness to believe that the overall feeling of commitment and care can guide us through descent, chaos, and crisis. Why do we allow those things to fall apart often? Why do we say, well, I won't try to do that anymore? You know, I had a young black bourgeois woman tell me I went somewhere to help these women, you know, and they were just so hostile. And I said, well, did you think about the way you framed it? Did you think about the location that you were coming from? And why with one attempt are you willing to give up? Do you give up that way in the relationships of intimacy in your life? Don't we struggle in the midst of patriarchy? Don't many of you who are heterosexual struggle with men daily, believing and hoping eternally that you can bring some greater good to the situation? And yet we don't bring that same eternal hope and conviction to our movement.
From the Wings Archive, Bits of Wisdom from the late Bell Hooks.
What does it mean that people can see so much violence and yet be aware of it but not feel compelled to change it?
Bell Hooks addressing the Texas Council on Family Violence in 1993.
People like you, people like those feminist activists who began the battered women's movement, have been truly successful in that we now have a culture that fundamentally acknowledges the reality of violence against women. People really do acknowledge today, most people, that incest happens, that domestic battery happens. Even people who don't want to have anything positive to say about feminism will acknowledge these realities. The difficulty we face is how do we move that acknowledgement past mere recognition into the willingness to do something every day of your life to change violence. And that is what I do not see. I have never forgiven Donahue, our, you know, talk show liberal male feminist, for that moment on his show when Scheherazade Ali was on there saying that sometimes black women need to be hit in the mouth. And there was Haki Madhubuti from Third World Press saying, indeed, I don't sell her books in my store because they condone violence against black women. And Donahue fixed that camera on him and he said, that's censorship. And my class and I have looked at that moment and we've talked about how in that moment on national television, what Donahue actually did with his camera and with his symbolic power was to say, violence against women is not a real political issue. Now, censorship and free speech, that's a real political issue. Did many of you see the film Thelma and Louise? There is that moment in Thelma and Louise at the beginning that to me is so powerful. When the attempted rape has been interrupted. And I'm forgetting right now which one of them, Thelma or Louise, says to the violent, battering, abusive white male at that moment, when a woman is crying, she's not having a good time. And to me, that was one of those magical moments in cinema and in film where I felt that anybody looking at that moment could click, it could click, like you could get it, like, wow. I suddenly realized that, in fact, when people are crying, often it signals perhaps that they're in pain, that they are sad, that something is wrong, that something is out of place. And I thought, this is the power of mass media, that it can make you feel for a moment something that can turn on that light bulb. But then I felt that what ultimately happened is the film then proceeded to undercut that moment throughout by making it seem like, well, guess what, world? Women are just as violent as men. Women are just as willing to humiliate men. Women will, you know, and I see this as a major theme running through how mass media is dealing with the issue of violence right now, saying things to us like men may be violent, but women are so violent too. And if women only had the power men had, they would be just as violent. So I've been thinking a lot about the naturalization and the normalization of violence. What I think is happening in our culture is that people feel incredibly powerless to change it because they feel like it is normative. They feel like it is natural. I can't tell you how many people say to me, Don't you think the impulse to hit, or that's just a natural thing, and that's just how boys are going to be. And I think about all the incredible work we've done within feminist movement, within the movement of domestic violence, to try to undercut that, and the message has still not gotten across to people, that it is not normative, that it is not natural, the act of doing violence. I'm willing to even allow that the impulse can be talked about as a, quote, natural impulse. I've been feeling very violent myself lately. And in fact, I've written a piece called Killing Rage, because I feel deeply enraged about the things that are not changing in this society. I had an experience recently that was the subject of this essay, and I want to talk about it here because I want to talk about how racism within and without the movement to end domestic violence continues to keep us apart. I got on an airplane with a black woman friend, and we were seated together in first class. We had those upgrades. And she had not been given a boarding pass. We were sitting in our little seats, and another black woman got on, and a white male was sitting in her seat and refused to move. The black woman was very nice. She said, "That's okay, I'll sit anywhere, da-da-da-da-da." And I have to say that even other white fellow white passengers asked this man to move. He was obstinate that he would not move. Then a white man got on who had a boarding pass for the seat that my friend was sitting in. He came to our sides and said, "You're sitting in my seat." And she said, "Oh no, I was given this seat." And then a few minutes later, she was called to the front of the plane. I said to her, "Don't move." She didn't listen to me. She moved. She went up, and it was explained to her that she was in this gentleman's seat. And while the stewardess were neatly negotiating our body space, he went and sat in the seat with her purse, with her belongings. Everybody was looking at us on the plane. We were the difficult, angry black women who were up there discussing this. And it was very clear that nothing was going to happen. And I went back to my seat. And Mr. Smiling Liberal White Man, no doubt a feminist man in his imagination, says to me, you know, he says, "I'm so sorry. It's unfortunate, but, you know, I didn't really have anything, you know, to do with this." I said, "Don't tell me you're sorry. You watched her being humiliated. You watched them call her up to the front of this plane. And you didn't say, 'There's no need for humiliation here. I'm willing to sit elsewhere.' Or you didn't say, 'I want my seat because I've been assigned to it, but I don't like what's taking place here. I don't condone what's taking place here.' I said, 'No, that seat was so important to you.'" And he had that little grin of, "I didn't let those, you know, wild black women, you know, get my seat." He had triumphed. And I felt rage towards him. And I'm going to be honest with you, if I could have killed him, I would have. And I don't say that lightly, and I don't say that. It didn't amuse me. I was scared that I felt that his refusal to see how racism and sexism work in this society and classism welled up in me so much that I felt murderous rage. And I'm telling you that everybody around me knew that I felt murderous rage, because it was coming out of my pores. And I had never felt that in my life before. And it was one of those things where on one level it was trivial, but deep within me, it was like all those incidences of a failure to understand difference and solidarity and what it means. And I just began to weep intensely. Because I felt that, why are we still having to deal with this? Why aren't people more aware? And I got out my pen and I began to write this essay that was called Killing Rage, Moving from Pain to Power. Because I feel that we have to hone our rage. We have to use it as a tool for vision and insight and understanding. This essay is a fine piece of work that came out of that rage. And I think that when we try to suppress our rage, it's when the dilemmas in our lives start. But one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I wanted to say, I also felt estranged from the black woman friend that I was with. I thought, why did she choose them over me? Why didn't she listen to me when I told her not to move from her seat? And I thought, why am I so angry at this injustice, and she seems to be more willing to conform? And at the end of the plane, I waited for her. And all these people came out, and all of a sudden I heard these voices screaming and yelling. And she came out, and she was in this intense battle with the stewardesses about racism and sexism. Because what had happened to her is when she went back to take the seat they said was hers, a white family was sitting there with their children. And do you know what they asked her? Would you be willing to give up your seat so this family can sit together? And she gave up her seat because she felt like she didn't really have any stake in the seat. But it enraged her that at no point was that white man asked, would he be willing to give up his seat so we could be together? Would he be willing to give up his seat so we wouldn't have to be humiliated publicly? In fact, he was invested in our humiliation. And I know that many of you out there have had these same struggles around race on your jobs, with the projection onto black women and black people in general that we are too angry, that we want something for nothing, that we disrupt the harmony of gatherings with our critiques. People tell me all the time, I'm just so tired of hearing black people talk about racism. You know, and that right there makes me get angry. You're tired of hearing people talk about racism? We are tired of experiencing racism. And we are tired of the ignorance about the connection between violence against women and the violence of racism and classism, because they converge. And I think that those of us who work around these issues see how they converge within us. I mean, look at the movement for domestic violence in this society. It has been a movement traditionally dominated by white women at the top and women of color as the victims, the people coming for services. That's how many people perceive of it. So what happens then when revolutionary, insightful women of color and black women come into such a movement and want to shake things up and want to deal with issues in a different way? We know what happens: confusion, anger, hostility, an end to discussion. I mean, the three words that I kept thinking about today in relation to talking to you was courage, challenge, commitment, four words, and confrontation. Because I think that part of why we have not furthered our will to end violence in this society is we are afraid of confrontation. We are afraid of the violent feelings we have in ourselves towards one another within this movement. I said this morning to a group of black women I was talking to, I believe that white women have tremendous feelings of violence towards black women. The sense that black women need to be silenced, that we're too uppity, that we need to be closed down in some way. I see that same spirit of violence in black men often. Close these black women down. Shut them up. They're getting out of order. They're trying to take over. I said to my sisters this morning, how many times do I go to give a talk where a white woman says to me, there's a black woman in my office and she's just so angry. She's, you know, we really want to work with her, but she's just so difficult. And this happens again and again and again, and I think, my God, haven't white women read our literature? Don't they understand the roots of this anger? You know, we used to think, and I think this is one of the things that's plaguing feminist movement and the movement to end domestic violence, we used to think that if you just put the knowledge in front of people, people would change. And what we find is knowledge does not in and of itself change people. People are altered through practice, through experiences, because you can have all the knowledge of something up here in your head. I can't tell you how many white women I encounter daily who have knowledge, book knowledge of racism, but who don't understand how they manipulate in meetings or what have you with silence, with smiles. You know, people, my students used to say, always say that if black women are talking rapidly, loud, aggressively, they see that as negative action. But if a white woman is talking a lot and she's smiling and she's quiet, they don't see her as potentially occupying space, asserting power, because we think of power differently. Last night we had a deep discussion, Joe, Sheila, Judy, and I, about the question of differences and commonalities. And I couldn't sleep because I was thinking about this discussion, because it does seem to me that women all over the world share commonalities in our suffering. That when we suffer at the hands of patriarchy, at the hands of male violence, there is nothing unique and special about the form and nature that our suffering takes. It is common. The problem becomes the reality of that shared suffering does not mediate the differences, the different ways we understand that pain. A black woman who may be battered by a black man but who feels that she can't call a white police structure, that may be very different from a white woman who feels like, well, you've got to call that structure, who doesn't understand that moment of hesitation, that reflection about what it means. You know, the commonality that black men and black women share, we share commonly the suffering to end racism. And yet, I talk to black men daily who say to me, they go on and on about white supremacy, and I say to them, but what about the issues confronting black women? And they'll say to me, well, black women are in cahoots with white men. And suddenly, there's a gendered reading of the experience of racism which says black men suffer more. And somehow black women are getting away with a lot. And I think, this is so sad given the reality of our experience. Why can't they recognize the different ways black women suffer? I hear black men and black people tell me all the time, well, you know, black men, if black men are violent towards black women and children, it's because the man is on them, because white supremacy is just hurting them so much. And I said, I don't buy that. White supremacy is hurting black women every day of our lives. But many of us do not go home and shoot and kill and maim and mutilate and beat. So what does that mean? You know, I have had to look back at my mother, who worked as a maid for white people. And when she came home from her little jobs, she used to be so bubbly and full of joy. And as a child, I had no idea that there might have been some violence to her spirit and herself and her humanity on that job. It never occurred to me to think about white female violent assaults on the personhood of black women, because the way she came home never suggested that I've just been denigrated. I've just been told to eat my little sandwich in the kitchen after I have prepared an elegant meal for the white family. She never conveyed any sense of what was done to her in that setting that might have made it extra hard for her to come home and be bubbly and share her little treats and give us that sense that all was right with our world. And what that says to me is that there is something within us that can handle our impulses to be violent, that can transform that rage into a generosity of spirit, love, and care. And if black women are capable of making that leap, then black men must be capable of making that same leap. And we must not buy into any structure that tells us that somehow black male violence against women is justified because of the pain black men experience at the hand of white racism. One of the things that we stayed up late into the night debating was the question of female violence against children. We were in disagreement about the enormity and the intensity of that and whether it was akin to male violence against women and children. Those of you who know my work, who've read my chapter on violence in feminist theory from margin to center, know that I am of that school that believes that part of the problem we have in ending violence is that so many women believe that violence is an acceptable means of social control. Even if they don't believe it is acceptable in their personal lives, they may feel that it's acceptable in the world beyond their lives. They may see young people like those young black females we saw on Donahue who would kill people. And the white women in that audience had no trouble standing up saying they should be locked away forever, that their lives should be taken away, that they should be punished beyond all belief. That's an endorsement of violence. But it's the notion of the acceptable violence, the violence that makes us safe, that makes us feel good. Part of what I feel we have to confront is, how can we enable people to see the interlocking nature of violence? So many white women and other groups of women can be against the violence of sexism, but have no trouble with the violence of racism, have no trouble actively assaulting other people of color, verbal assault, when it's in their interest to do so.
On Wings, excerpts from Bell Hooks' keynote address to the Texas Council on Family Violence in 1993. She went on to deconstruct a current sitcom that normalized rejection of black women and transvestites, and a recent film that created entertainment from the slaughter of a black gay man and a Korean couple.
I live on a corner that has a Korean grocer. I had never witnessed any kind of negative encounter between black youth and those store owners, but once that film came into being, every time I went in, it's not so much that people look at violence and think that it's not wrong. They may look at it and think that it's wrong, but it's so exciting. It's so pleasurable. It's more intense and more fulfilling than any kind of effort towards nonviolence could ever be. I think that this is a deep and profound moment. How do we intervene on that seduction of violence? I had to ask myself, I watch a lot of films. Would I 10 years
Hi,
ago
I'm
have
Amy Goodman,
to
host
kill
of
that
Democracy.
White man on the plane? Or would I have believed that with my Christianity of that time, with everything, I could convert him? Why was my immediate impulse so deeply violent? And I think it has to do with the intimacy of violence in all our lives, the normative nature of it, the way it creeps up in all our interactions. I want to close by saying that I thought a lot about, why have we been so afraid of facing that violence within ourselves that comes up? Black female hatred and anger towards white women, the violence that comes up in these meetings. The violence when you just feel like, I wish I could go over and slap her. I wish I could pull her hair. I wish I could make her understand. Is that violence so radically different from the violence a batterer feels? I was talking on the phone and I found that this boyfriend of mine that I'm breaking up with had told me another lie, and I kept thinking, I wish I could beat him to death with this telephone. I wish I could just start pounding on him with this telephone so I could make him understand that this is serious. You know, I talked to my sister the other day, and her child had done something that was deeply upsetting, lied, disobeyed, gone out, left the door open, all of these things that potentially placed her in danger as a young woman in a large urban city in a poor neighborhood. And I said, well, what did you do? She said, I beat her. I had to beat her. I had to make her understand. And I said to her, but do you remember when Mama used to beat us to make us understand? And did we understand? Did the light go off? Did the magic happen for us that I've been beaten and I understand? You know? But what saddened me was I felt that she, and when we talked about it, the enormity of her feeling of powerlessness. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do to make her understand the seriousness of this situation. That she could have been raped. That she could have been battered. That the other children whom she left in the house with the door open could have been hurt. I didn't know how to make her understand the seriousness of that. So that I think that we are so bombarded right now with that tragic dimension, that tragic feeling of powerlessness. And it's interesting because she said to me that, you know, I'm going to find a therapist for her. And I said to her, but you know, you may have to find a therapist for yourself to find out what is a more productive way I can intervene on this situation. I mean, this is a woman who has honed her feminist insights, a working class woman in America who has grown, who has broken out of the sexism in her domestic household, who has resisted. And yet, when faced with a situation of crisis, She falls back on